The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Discover a team that's always here to support you at All Care, taking care of communities across Ireland.
Niall Quinn, football superstar, good morning.
Hey Brendan, how are you?
I'm good. Niall, there's a two-part series looking at your life and times and your career starting on Wednesday on Virgin Media 2. And listen, it's a good thing the football worked out for you because you had turned down a good steady job as a postman, hadn't you, to pursue the soccer?
Yeah, I got the junior postman offered to me in 1983 in Dublin, which I only went to because it was a half day off school. And I think there was about 1,000 young kids around the country trying to get one of the 30 places that was made available. And I received a letter a week later saying I'd been selected and that I'd have to leave school. So it was a bit of a shock, but I held on to it. I don't think I told anybody for a little while. And then the offer came to go to England and I took that one up. Instead, obviously, went over to Arsenal and things were different, as you say.
Yeah. And of course, if you'd taken the postman job, we would have let you keep up your hurling career. But anyway, look, the football did work out, as we say. So come here, you went over to Arsenal, you were 17?
Just turned 17. I played in an All-Ireland minor hurling final as a 16-year-old in the first week of September. I went on trial to Arsenal about a week later. And 2 weeks after that, I was over in Arsenal. So I hadn't played a soccer match for about 4 months before my trial. And I kind of went, having already failed a trial at Fulham, which was a much smaller club. So I kind of went over there thinking, well, look, I'll have a good time. It'd be lovely to see if I manage to get to see any of the first team players like Dave O'Leary, Pat Jennings, all these great superstars that were there. And lo and behold, all of the young lads at the club were on their first week off since July, and I was ending up training every day with the Arsenal first team. And so they liked me. Don Howe and Terry Neal were there, and I was meant to stay for 2 weeks. And after 5 days, they sent me back to Ireland and said, we'll be bringing you over to England. And that's how quick it all happened for me. I was playing minor hurling 3 weeks earlier.
And did you have family, friends, support structure or whatever in London, or did you care at that point?
Yeah, no, my auntie and uncle took me in, which was great. My auntie Ailish and Uncle Matty, they were fantastic. And so I had somewhere to go. Now, it was a long way away from Highbury, where we used to have to be in every day to do duties and get the kit ready for all the training of the other teams. And I had to be on a 20 past six bus every morning near Twickenham Stadium to get to Hounslow, to get the tube right across London, to get in there 8:15 every morning to make sure that all the kit was done. And I had a guaranteed pro contract, so I had time. It was a 3-year deal, and it was just as well, Brendan, because I was absolutely shattered in the first year. I wasn't physically able for a training every day. It was a huge shock. My form wasn't good in the matches, and I kind of think about it now when I see players thrown in at a young age, and some people say, no, they're not ready for it, it's not good enough. I needed time. I needed to fill out. I needed somebody to believe in me, and thankfully, yeah, you know, the coaches there gave me that time.
And listen, you make it sound like all hard work and everything, but you did kind of started managing to have a good time as well. It was a different life back then, wasn't it? It was like in the sense of it was an ordinary enough life for you guys. Like you could, you know, even when you were playing for Arsenal and starting to get well known, you could kind of go down the pub and all that kind of thing and, you know, lead a relatively normal existence.
Yeah, I think we all had it in our contracts that we weren't allowed to visit a pub 48 hours before a match. But you could for the 5 days of the week, which was the way it was in those days. But having said that, I think you also have to remember that when we walked into a pub, having played in the first team and having got an A for myself, the people were actually delighted to see you. You know, they wouldn't be squealing on you and putting you on, there was no social media then, but they wouldn't be putting you on Facebook and saying, yeah, Look at this guy's a disgrace. They would actually be delighted to see you and they'd say, fair play, it's great of you to come in, all the best Saturday. It was just a different time, you know, the professionalism hadn't come the way it was going to. It came with the foreign explosion when a lot of foreign players came into the Premier League when it first started in the early to mid 90s. I mean, the first couple of years of the Premier League, there was no difference at all. There was some pom-pom dancers before the match around the centre circle, but yeah, Effectively that was about it. But then, of course, with the impact of foreign players coming and the professionalism, the likes of Arsene Wenger coming along and changing how footballers, you know, would prepare themselves, and the whole thing just took off from there. And I have to say, I have great admiration for the players of today, the sacrifices they make. I'm not so sure I would have the head for it to do that today.
Yeah. You had two drinking scenes. You had the footballing drinking scene, and then you had the Irish drinking scene, the National in Kilburn and the Galtymore and all that kind of scene.
Yes. Yeah. No, I had two lives. I had two separate lives. I mean, the football scene, we were young lads at Arsenal. Things were going well. We weren't paid very well, but we'd be kind of in those days, in the yuppie 80 days, it was wine bar sort of journeys, you know. Oh, we go to this wine bar, go to that wine bar. And then the exact opposite of that was, you know, maybe the next day or maybe the Saturday night or whatever, not going out with the footballers and going out with my pals who were, like me, were over living in London trying to get on. And we'd do the Galtee Moor, all these various places, the Gresham, the National, as you say. And I did all the big Toms of this world, you know, Declan Nerney's, all these people over, Cathy Jenkins. And I got into it. It was good. It was a nice escape. And very quickly, I gave up the wine bars and didn't give up the Irish clubs, though. That's always kind of stayed with me.
Yeah, we always found that, we would have gravitated down towards kind of the indie music scene in Camden. But really, if you wanted to meet girls who would talk to you, it was back to the National in Kilburn for that kind of thing. They were more, the Irish girls there were more amenable to Irish guys, weren't they?
Yeah, you'd feel a lot more comfortable. And I can remember one night dancing with a girl from Cork one time, and it was really wrong of me. She said, "What do you do?" I said, "I'm a footballer." And she went, "Good one. You're the third person who said that to me, and the other two were complete wasters. So all the best." And walked off. And from that moment on, I never told anybody, until people got to know me better, that I was a footballer. I was mortified.
Yeah. But listen, the scene with the footballers and like the likes of Tony Adams has talked about that, the Tuesday Club, and the kind of culture was that the older players and your mentors and that would bring you to the pub and bring you to the bookies office and stuff. That was how you were socialised into things, was it?
It probably wasn't as straightforward as that. I think, you know, you had an awful lot of spare time in your hands. And I went over with the best intentions. My mother was a teacher. I was going to stay with my auntie and uncle for the first year and I was going to go to college. But a couple of months in, I was so tired, I was shattered, I couldn't get my head around college. And the easiest thing to do then in the afternoon when you came home was to you know, jump off the tube, and rather than go straight home back to my auntie and uncle's, you go into the bookies, have a few bets. Then I found the snooker hall, and eventually a year later when I moved up to near the Highbury and the training ground out at London Colney, there was players my age that were nearby and they were doing the sort of snooker hall and the bookies. And it was just a way of life that you got into. I think when you went up the ladder and got into the first team, you were still very much, you know, there might be two or three young lads, Paul Merrison, myself, Tony, Dave Rocastle. There's a few of us that were kind of in awe a little bit of the senior players, the Dave O'Leary's of this world and, you know, Graeme Rix's, Paul Mariner, all these top players, Tony Woodcock. So it wasn't really like that. But then occasionally you'd have dues. There'd be a Christmas party for the players and you'd get to know them better then. Mm. But you were always, I always felt safer just stepping away from that and heading into my own world, the snooker hall world, the pubs that I would go to with my Irish friends. And I lived with a couple of Irish guys for a few years, Nigel Traynor, Mick Kavanagh, Paddy Hughes, otherwise, you know, and we kind of looked out for each other. So I had this football life going on, which was cool. But I also had the reality of not having as much money sometimes as my friends from Ireland, because I wasn't in the team and not getting bonuses and appearance money. My wages were low and I'd be borrowing off them the odd weekend, you know.
And come here, you know, obviously a few of those guys kind of infamously then got themselves in trouble with drink and gambling and that. And Tony Adams and Paul Merson have talked a lot about their addictions and stuff. Did you have a kind of a self-preservation instinct, or was it going back to your having that base of the Irish friends or whatever that kind of kept you out of that kind of trouble, do you think?
I think I was lucky, Brendan. I didn't go over the edge. I went close a few times. You know, I had to take a real hard think and look at myself at various times on that journey. And easy come, easy go was probably where I was. Yeah, even I was getting money. Ah, yeah, look, sure, hell, it's money's to be spent. Now, I wasn't buying outrageous clothes or anything like that. In fact, as you'll see from one of the videos they have, I didn't spend money at all on my clothes in those days. But I kind of did blow it when I think of it. Not a lot of, we were very small money, but I did, you know, say, right, okay, I'm going into bookies today. I have 200 quid. I'm going to make 500. And I'd come out and I'd have 10 quid left and I'd have to go up and get the clothes washed, a couple of coins to go down to the laundrette. And people looking at you go, that's that fellow who plays for Arsenal. And I'm there, you know, sort of in this big washateria trying to get my washing done with the last 7 or 8 quid on me. But do you know, in some ways, you know, I learned to respect it. I always say that about George Graham. He totally underpaid me in particular, but he did you know, teach me the value of a pound. So by the time I got up to Man City years later, and then I got to Sunderland as I hit 30 years of age, I was better by then. I was saving. I could still drink and have a pint and do my thing. I didn't do the nightclubs thing, but I think I met you in Lily's Bordello one night and we had a rare old chat.
And listen, that was the only time the two of us ever went to Lily's. Just coincidence.
But I generally stayed away from that and just did it. You know, I liked the pubs and And I think that helped as well. I drank beer. I didn't go to nightclubs and, you know, drink the shorts. And
so did you ever lose a run of yourself at any point, really?
My wife would say I went a little bit AWOL at times and went close to the edge. And I kind of know why. You know, when things aren't going well for you and you have a career that you know, in many ways, you know, had, and then you're sort of at the end of it and you don't know where you're going. The career transition, I didn't handle that very successfully. So that was a low point. But I would say in general, I understood how lucky I was, and I was pretty good natured and good humored most of the time. I did actually work hard. You know, I trained really, really hard. I sort of put everything in. People say, oh, that's a contradiction because you said you also went to the pub. But that was just the way things were at that time. But I had a determination. I think that got me there. And sometimes I get frustrated because that determination I had, it doesn't work in other things in life, you know, when you try and do things later on. But, you know, eventually I found my way after my football career, and I can look back on it now and smile and laugh. But I visited a few funny places, you know, when you quit. And I think lots of players do. There's a theory there that we are wired a little bit differently to get to the top. And when you quit, the wires go a bit haywire on you, a bit rogue. And you don't handle not being the center of attention. You don't handle being the star, the adulation and the kind of hype that goes with that. So I would say, looking back now, that there's real merit in that.
Yeah. So I suppose that you hit that point where you're still quite young, and is there a sense that, like, the most exciting part of my life is behind me now?
I think there was. I hit a low patch, definitely. I had a great first few months afterwards because I wasn't training every day, and I'd broken out of the routine, that real tough routine, because I was training harder at 35, 36 to stay part of it.
Yeah, than of
I
course, was. Right.
Yeah, you know, and things had changed. The players had become much fitter. The Premier League was a different place than the league that I'd started out in. But I suppose I wasn't prepared. I would implore players nowadays to think about career transition long before your time is up, because I literally went from one bad conversation with a new manager who came in who didn't want me, to almost packing up that evening and saying, right, we're finished, we're going home. I had no plans in place, Brendan. That was a huge problem for me. I that routine that I went into was gone as well. And I know an awful lot more about it now, particularly since my wife Gillian went back to college. She did a psychology degree after the kids were reared, and she's now currently halfway through a doctorate, and she's looking at the career transition of footballers. And why? Because we'd have had lots of friends who we thought were in much more solid marriages than us, and their marriages fall apart after the player quits. We managed to hang in there and get through, but a lot of our friends and my colleagues didn't. And so Gillian has gone and researched this very deeply, and I begin to see what I was and the mistakes I made, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So is she to be able to help footballers at that point, ultimately, yeah?
Yeah, if things go well for her, I think that's exactly what she wants to do. And I think it was interesting, just yesterday she was reading a report that was done on rugby league, I think, and rugby union in Australia. And those who were prepared for their career transition perform much better than those who aren't. So it's something that I think should be embraced. And I think it is. I think that the tide is turning.
Yeah, and rugby has certainly put a lot more thought and effort into it in recent years, hasn't it?
They sure have. They're a great example to the rest of sport. And I think, you know, football clubs are always saying, we want you to play, don't be thinking about retirement. I think you'll find now that players who are happier, more content, have their futures planned, then they're the ones who do better. And the only advice I could say to any sportsman who's, you know, on their path, maybe at the pinnacle of the career, wherever they're going on the way up, is to think about it. And if you can use the greatness that you have in this particular sport to be able to get something after it ends that you love doing, then you've had a real worthwhile career. Because to jump out of bed after your sports career is over because you love what you're doing, that's the goal, that's the holy grail. And it took me a long time to find that, and I know other players, you know, in the exact same boat. So that's the advice I'd give.
And listen, speaking of those highs that you're leaving behind, you know, Dermot O'Callaghan was in here a couple of weeks ago and he was talking about watching rugby as a fan now, right? And he said he only realises now how important it is to fans, the matches and everything. And he, when he was in the bubble playing, he had no idea how important it was to people and he wished he did. And I gather you didn't fully appreciate, say, what something like Italia 90 meant in Ireland until last year when you saw all the footage around the time Jack Charlton died.
Yeah, it was the 30th anniversary, so there was a lot of footage of Italia 90 at the early part of the year. And then obviously Jack and Morris, his assistant, passing away very sadly. There was a lot of it on TV and we're in lockdown, we're all doing watching TV, etc. And I kept getting called in, hey, you're on, there's something on. And I'd go in and I would see the crowds that were following the bus in from the airport, those meeting us at the airport in a college green. And it kind of came back to me, although I will always remember on the flight home from Italy, as we approached Dublin, the pilot veered off course and said, I'm just going to bring you over O'Connell Street. Everybody look out the window to the left. And we were all jovial, having a bit of fun on the plane. And we all looked out on the left and the whole plane just went, wow. Because there looked to be just hundreds of thousands of ants lining the streets around O'Connell Street and the Liffey and the bridge. And that's when we all took a gulp and went, wow, this was pretty serious. Because we had no real idea, other than phoning your family, what things were like. And then to come back and find out what it was like, that was good. But then we were off doing our thing. I mean, I headed off around the country for a week. I went off with a country and western music promoter who I know, Frankie Kilbride, and he had me who I met in those London clubs that you mentioned. And Frankie brought me from north, south, east and west of Ireland, I think, to every country and western hall he could get me in. And I was like the Beatles for about 10 days.
Did you have a turn that you did, or did you just show up and say hello to people?
I kind of just showed up and said hello, and they all started singing ole, ole, ole everywhere I went. But to my great, I don't know, it was my shame, but I do actually remember singing I Used to Love Her with Kathy Durkin on the stage in the Galtymore with about 2,000 people a couple of years later. So to say I was losing the run of myself was putting it mildly, I think.
Listen, in more recent events now, so you became deputy interim CEO of the FAI from January to September you were involved. I suppose the first question is, like, why get involved in something that was such a mess?
Yeah, good question. I felt it was my duty. I knew and had been told, you know, that the government and the bank, who were the serious stakeholders at the time, were looking to see more confidence in there, and that they would be quite pleased if I would come in. I'd done a lot of talking about it through the media and saying how bad things were and it should be better. So sometimes you have to kind of, you know, put your money where your mouth is, and I decided to go in and help Gary Owens. We kind of both knew, if the truth be known, that we weren't going to be very popular, that the change that was needed wasn't going to be, you know, easily achieved. And that played itself out. You know, there was lots of stakeholders who felt, you know, that they were misjudged in this sort of development, and that the blame was being shifted elsewhere other than, say, in John Delaney's path. And it was a little bit helter-skelter, but at the same time, you know, I think the governance that needed to be brought in and has come in, and the fact that the government have started to give money back to the FAI, it means things are better now. Hopefully the new CEO can kick on. And I was really encouraged by Minister Chambers last week saying that, you know, the government will support the FAI through the pandemic. I think that was big, because if you remember a year ago, it wasn't like that, you know, the government were having nothing to do with it. So in there, we knew there was a role. It was 6 months to do. So it was always
only going to... Niall, were you greeted by chaos when you went in there? Because obviously to us from the outside, right, it looked like a complete shambles. One guy had dominated this whole organisation, and now he seemed to be pulling the whole edifice down with him, if you will. And everybody, kind of a lot of people related into him in various dysfunctional ways.
Yeah, that's the outward view. But I'd have to say that when I went into that FAI, I understood it an awful lot more than I ever did. I was on the outside thinking exactly that when I went in. But what I found there was the vast majority of people do superb work in that association at grassroots level, at League of Ireland level, You know, there's a workforce of just over 200. Their jobs are in jeopardy. And delighted that those jobs have managed to survive, because I think, you know, there's a kind of an unsung sort of workforce in there that do great things. Where obviously the problems were up at the top in terms of, you know, the governance and how everything was ran. And that's to play itself out still. But I think the measures that have been put in place were difficult to accept for some, but I think it's in a decent enough place now. And job done in terms of what Gary Owens and I were asked to do, to bring in, you know, make sure that governance came in, financial governance, electoral governance, etc. The clubs, you know, then all, and the football family then had the pandemic thrown at them, literally from the start. So to deal with that was tough. To get the League of Ireland, you know, through even half a season was a bit of an achievement. But I think the fact that the new CEO has taken over now, Jonathan Hill, who would have no links, no baggage to any side or any history of, you know, involvement with the association, I think that's a good thing. And it augurs well that he could be the man then to unify it more and to bring it back into a better place. And I have a great confidence in the board as well. The board has reorganized itself. Some football people there to make sure that football is well looked after, and some good business people, legal people, you know, to make sure that the structures and that the governance is top class. So it's still got a way to go, and it would be great. Listen, if Stephen Kenny's team were winning lots of matches, I think maybe the noise would be different. But there's a long way back for the association, but I think it's on the right way, and I hope for its sake as well that Stephen manages to get a few results.
Okay, listen, you talked about Gillian doing her PhD. You're gone back to study history now, are you?
Well, I did, yeah. I always loved history. And as I said to you, I didn't go to college when I should have done in London. My mother's a teacher, 90 years of age. She's still alive. And I always told her I would. So I'm kind of paying back a debt, scratching that itch, if you like. I loved history. And I signed up to DCU for a history course. And we haven't met up yet as a class. But from September, since I did that, I've really enjoyed it. And I found out so much about Irish history that I never realized. Well, I was your quintessential Christian Brothers guy who just did Irish history. You were told, you know, that 1916 was a great thing that happened, and here's a load of songs that you have to learn. So I'd learned O'Donnell Abu and A Nation Once Again, and, you know, that was my history. But to go deeper and go under the layers and to see how Ireland was at that time, I mean, it's quite amazing to think how the suffrage movement was going where it was and the role women were playing, conscription to the World War and John Redmond and Home Rule that was about to happen. Everybody thought it was in a great place. And as you know, initially the 1916 leaders were jeered and hissed by the public. But then the catastrophic English reaction to that, and I suppose then everything that went on after that, Sinn Féin winning the election, the War of Independence, then Civil War. It's absolutely incredible. And that's just one little portion. And I'm doing 1600 to the maybe the 1980s. So I'm really enjoying it. Super class. We haven't met yet, but we will.
Okay, so listen, your next TV programme then could be Niall Quinn's Ireland's Television History, to update the Robert Key programme.
No, I don't think I'd be taking on anybody like that. But I would also say to anybody, you know, in this time, if you can get on courses and you had this thing in the back of your mind to go and do it, it is so worth it. I am absolutely having a ball. I mightn't be as good as the others. It's 37 years since I was in a classroom. But I just find that even the teamwork from the others is great. You know, people help each other out in these circumstances. And I would recommend adult learning, you know, to anybody who would be even thinking about it.
Okay. Niall, before you go, did you know Paul McGrath growing up in Crumlin or that? I know he would have been older than you, but have you kept in touch with him down the years, or do you see him or that?
Yeah, time. Yeah, Paul is doing great. I get to see a lot. He's on Instagram and he walks every day and he sends these brilliant photographs. So it's great to see him doing that. Paul was kind of a hero in our area growing up. I didn't know him. And I can remember one time when he was home from Man United before I went to England. I was working in the Crumlin Health Centre, which was a gymnasium and swimming pool beside Crumlin Shopping Centre. And I was working there and he came in to do workouts two or three days in a row. And I remember spying on him in the gym, looking at the stuff he was doing. So I would do what he was doing. And then obviously I got in the Irish team a few years later, and he became my teammate. And look, it goes without saying, Paul was just a most incredible player, incredible man to go through everything he did, to still perform on the world stage the way he did. He's all of our favorite. You know, if you asked any of us from that time, asked Jack, asked a lot, you know, Paul was the one. Paul was just, he epitomized everything about Ireland, I think, at that time. Our meteoric rise to get to the quarterfinal of the World Cup, then later on in America, the way he played. Paul made us all feel great as a team, and I know he did for the people as well. Sadly, the last time I met him was in one of the easier lockdown periods when we were able to go and offer condolences at his mother's funeral there not so long ago. So, a super guy, just, you know, somebody I can't tell you how proud he made his teammates feel by by how he played, but B, who he is.
Okay, Niall Quinn, thanks for that. And episode one of Boot Room to Boardroom airs this Wednesday at 10:15 p.m. on Virgin Media 2. And Niall, you're back on Tuesday for the return of the Champions League on Virgin Media Sport, am I right?
Yeah, looking forward to that. Yeah, we've Leipzig playing Liverpool, not in Germany because of the pandemic and the new strains. And we've Barcelona and PSG. So some good stuff happening.
Okay, Niall Quinn, absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian. Same here.